Lunchtime, said Spider, and you're late for work again. It's a good thing I didn't cover for you again, if this is all the thanks I get.
It's okay, said Fat Charlie. I've been given 2 weeks off. And a bonus.
Spider raised an eyebrow.
Look, said Fat Charlie, feeling like it was time to move to the second round of the argument. It's not like I'm trying to get rid of you or anything, but I was wondering when you were thinking of leaving.
Spider said, well, when I came here, I'd only planned to visit for a day, maybe 2 days, long enough to meet my little brother, and then I'd be on my way. I'm a busy man.
So you're leaving today?
That was my plan, said Spider, but then I met you. I cannot believe that we have let almost an entire lifetime go by without each other's company, my brother.
I can.
The ties of blood, said Spider, are stronger than water.
Water's not strong, objected Fat Charlie.
Stronger than vodka, then, or volcanoes, or ammonia. Look, my point is that meeting you, well, it's a privilege. We've never been part of each other's lives, but that was yesterday. Let's start a new tomorrow today. We'll put yesterday behind us and forge new bonds. The bonds of brotherhood.
You're totally after Rosie, said Fat Charlie.
Totally, agreed Spider. What do you plan to do about it?
Do about it? Well, she's my fiancée.
Not to worry. She thinks I'm you.
Will you stop saying that?
Spider spread his hands in a saintly gesture, then ruined the effect by licking his lips.
So, said Fat Charlie, what are you planning to do next? Marry her, pretending to be me?
Marry? Spider paused and thought for a moment. What a horrible idea.
Well, I was quite looking forward to it, actually.
Spider does not marry. I'm not the marrying kind.
So, my rose is not good enough for you, is that what you're saying?
Spider did not answer. He walked out of the room. Fat Charlie felt like he'd scored somehow in the argument. He got up from the sofa, picked up the empty foil cartons that had the previous evening held a chicken chow mein and a crispy pork balls, and he dropped them into the bin. He went into his bedroom, where he took off the clothes he had slept in order to put on clean clothes, discovered that due to not doing the laundry, he had no clean clothes, so brushed yesterday's clothes down vigorously, dislodging several stray strands of chow mein, and put them back on. He went into the kitchen. Spider was sitting at the kitchen table, enjoying a steak large enough for two people.
"Where did you get that from?"
said Fat Charlie, although he was certain that he already knew.
"I asked you if you wanted lunch," said Spider mildly. "Where did you get that steak?"
"It was in the fridge."
"That!" declaimed Fat Charlie, wagging his finger like a prosecuting attorney going in for the kill. "That was the steak I bought for dinner tonight. For dinner tonight for me and Rosie. The dinner I was going to be cooking for her. And you're just sitting there like a person eating a steak and eating it, and—"
"It's not a problem," said Spider.
"What do you mean, not a problem?"
"Well," said Spider, "I called Rosie this morning already, and I'm taking her out to dinner tonight, so you wouldn't have needed the steak anyway."
Fat Charlie opened his mouth. He closed it again.
"I want you out," he said.
"It's a good thing for a man's desire to outstrip his something or other, grasp or reach or something, or what else is heaven for," said Spider cheerfully between mouthfuls of Fat Charlie's steak.
"What the hell does that mean?"
"It means I'm not going anywhere. I like it here." He hacked off another lump of steak, shoveled it down.
"Out," said Fat Charlie, and then the hall telephone rang.
Fat Charlie sighed, walked into the hall, and answered it.
"What? Ah, Charles, good to hear your voice. I know you're currently enjoying your well-earned, but do you think it might be within the bounds of possibility for you to swing by for, half an hour or so tomorrow morning, say around 10-ish?
"Yeah, of course," said Fat Charlie. "Not a problem."
"Delighted to hear it. I'll need your signature on some papers. Well, until then—"
"Who was that?" asked Spider. He had cleaned his plate and was blotting his mouth with a paper towel.
"Graham Coates. He wants me to pop in tomorrow."
Spider said, "He's a bastard."
"So? You're a bastard."
"Different kind of bastard. He's not good news. You should find another job."
"I love my job."
Fat Charlie meant it when he said it. He had managed entirely to forget how much he disliked his job and the Graham Coates agency and the ghastly lurking behind every door presence of Graham Coates.
Spider stood up.
"Nice piece of steak," he said. "I've set my stuff up in your spare room."
"You've what?"
Fat Charlie hurried down to the end of the hall, where there was a room that technically qualified his residence as a two-bedroom flat. The room contained several boxes of books, a box containing an elderly scale-electric racing set, a tin box filled with Hot Wheels cars, most of them missing tyres, and various other battered remnants of Fat Charlie's childhood. It might have been a good-sized bedroom for a normal-sized garden gnome or an undersized dwarf, but for anyone else, it was a closet with a window. Or rather, it used to be. But it wasn't. Not anymore. Fat Charlie pulled the door open and stood in the hallway, blinking. There was a room, yes, that much was still true, but it was an enormous room. A magnificent room. There were windows at the far end, huge picture windows looking out over what appeared to be a waterfall. Beyond the waterfall, the tropical sun was low on the horizon, and it burnished everything in its golden light. There was a fireplace large enough to roast a pair of oxen, upon which three burning logs crackled and spat. There was a hammock in one corner, along with a perfectly white sofa and a four-poster bed. Near the fireplace was something that Fat Charlie, who had only ever seen them in magazines, suspected was probably some kind of jacuzzi. There was a zebra-skin rug and a bear pelt hanging on one wall, and there was the kind of advanced piece of audio equipment that consists of a black piece of polished plastic that you wave at. On one wall hung a flat television screen that was the width of the room that should have been there, and there was more.
"What have you done?" asked Fat Charlie. He did not go in.
"Well," said Spider from behind him, "seeing as I'm going to be here for a few days, I thought I'd bring my stuff over."
"Bring your stuff? Bringing your stuff is a couple of carrier bags filled with laundry, some PlayStation games and a spider plant. This is...
He was out of words. Spider patted Fat Charlie's shoulder as he pushed past. "If you need me," he said to his brother, "I'll be in my room." And he shut the door behind him. Fat Charlie shook the doorknob. The door was now locked. He went into the TV room, got the phone from the hall, and dialed Mrs. Higgler's number.
"What the hell is this at this time in the morning?" she said.
"It's me, Fat Charlie. I'm sorry."
"Well, what you calling about?"
"Well, I was calling to ask your advice. You see, my brother came out here."
"Your brother?"
"Spider. You told me about him. You said to ask a spider if I wanted to see him, and I did, and he's here."
"Well,"
she said noncommittally,
"that's good."
"It's not."
"Why not? His family, isn't he?"
"Look, I can't go into it now. I just want him to go away."
"Have you tried asking him nicely?"
"We just got through with all that. He says he isn't going. He's set up something that looks like the pleasure dome of Kubla Khan in my box room. And, I mean, round here you need the council's permission just to put in double glazing. He's got some kind of waterfall in there. Not in there, it's on the other side of the window, and he's after my fiancée."
"Oh, do you know?"
"He said so." Mrs. Higgler said,
"I'm not at my best before I have my coffee.
I just need to know how to make him go away."
"I don't know," said Mrs. Higgler. "I will talk to Mrs. Dunwoody about it."
She hung up. Fat Charlie went back down to the end of the corridor and knocked on the door.
"What is it now?"
"I want to talk." The door clicked and swung open. Fat Charlie went inside. Spider was reclining, naked, in the hot tub. He was drinking something more or less the colour of electricity from a long frosted glass. The huge picture windows were now wide open, and the roar of the waterfall contrasted with the low, liquid jazz that emanated from hidden speakers somewhere in the room. "Look," said Fat Charlie, "you have to understand, this is my house." Spider blinked.
"This?" he asked. "This is your house?"
"Well, not exactly, but the principle's the same. I mean, we're in my spare room, and you're a guest. Spider sipped his drink and luxuriated deeper in the hot water.
"They say," he said, "that house guests are like fish. They both stink after 3 days."
"Good point," said Fat Charlie.
"But it's hard," said Spider. "Hard when you've gone a lifetime not seeing your brother. Hard when he didn't even know you existed. Harder still when you finally see him and learn that, as far as he's concerned, you're no better than a dead fish."
"But," said Fat Charlie. Spider stretched in the tub.
"I'll tell you what," he said. "I can't stay here forever. Chill. I'll be gone before you know it. And for my part, I will never think of you as a dead fish. And I appreciate that we're both under a lot of stress. So let's say no more about it. Why don't you go and get yourself some lunch, leave your front door key behind, and then go see a movie.
Fat Charlie put on his jacket and went outside. He put his door key down beside the sink. The fresh air was wonderful, although the day was grey and the sky was spitting drizzle. He bought a newspaper to read. He stopped at the chippy and bought a large bag of chips and a battered saveloy for his lunch. The drizzle stopped, so he sat on a bench in the churchyard and read his newspaper and ate his saveloy and chips. He very much wanted to see a film. He wandered into the Odeon, bought a ticket for the first thing showing. It was an action adventure, and it was already on when he went inside. Things blew up. It was great. Halfway through the film, it occurred to Fat Charlie that there was something that he was not remembering. It was in his head somewhere, like an inch behind his eyes, and it kept distracting him. The film ended. Fat Charlie realized that, although he had enjoyed it, he had not actually managed to keep much of the film he had just seen in his head. So he bought a large bag of popcorn and sat through it again. It was even better the second time. And the third. After that, he thought that perhaps he ought to think about getting home, but there was a late-night double feature of Eraserhead and True Stories, and he'd never actually seen either film, so he watched them both, although he was by now really quite hungry, which meant that by the end he was unsure of what Eraserhead had actually been about, or what the lady was doing in the radiator, and he wondered if they'd let him stay and watch it again, but they explained very patiently over and over that they were going to close for the night, and inquired as to whether he didn't have a home to go to, and wasn't it time for him to be in bed? And of course he did, and it was, although the fact of it had slipped his mind for a while. So he walked back to Maxwell Gardens, and was slightly surprised to see that the light was on in his bedroom. The curtains were drawn as he reached the house. Still, there were silhouettes on the window, moving about. He thought he recognized both of the silhouettes. They came together. They blended into one shadow. Fat Charlie uttered one deep and terrible howl. In Mrs. Dunwoody's house, there were many plastic animals. The dust moved slowly through the air in that place, as if it were better used to the sunbeams of a more leisurely age, and could not be doomed with all this fast modern light. There was a transparent plastic cover on the sofa, and chairs that crackled when he sat down on them. In Mrs. Dunwoody's house, there was pine-scented hard toilet paper. Mrs. Dunwoody believed in economy, and pine-scented hard toilet paper was at the bottom of her economy drive. You could still get hard toilet paper, if you looked long enough and were prepared to pay more for it. Mrs. Dunwoody's house smelled of violet water. It was an old house. People forget that the children born to settlers in Florida were already old men and women when the Dour Puritans landed at Plymouth Rock. The house didn't go that far back. It had been built in the 1920s, during a Florida land development scheme to be the show house to represent the hypothetical houses that all the other buyers would find themselves eventually unable to build on the plots of Gatory Swamp that were being sold. Mrs. Dunwoody's house had survived hurricanes without losing a roof tile. When the doorbell rang, Mrs. Dunwoody was stuffing a small turkey. She tutted and washed her hands, and then walked down the corridor to her front door, peering out at the world through her thick, thick glasses, her left hand trailing on the wallpaper. She opened the door a crack and peered out.
"Luella? It's me!"
It was Callie-Ann Higgler.
"Come in!"
Mrs. Higgler followed Mrs. Dunwoody back to the kitchen. Mrs. Dunwoody ran her hands under the tap, then recommenced taking handfuls of soggy cornbread stuffing and pushing them deep into the turkey.
"You expecting company?"
Mrs. Dunwoody made a non-committal noise.
"Always a good idea to be prepared," she said. "Now, suppose you tell me what's going on."
"Nancy's boy, Fat Charlie."
"What about him?"
"Well, I tell him about his brother, when he out here last week."
Mrs. Dunwoody pulled her hand out of the turkey.
"That's not the end of the world," she said.
"I tell him how he can contact his brother."
"Ah,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody. She could disapprove with just that one syllable.
"And?"
"He's turned up in Hinglan. Boy's at his wit's end."
Mrs. Dunwoody took a large handful of wet cornbread and rammed it into the turkey with a force that would have made the turkey's eyes water if he still had any.
"Can't get him to go away?"
"Nope."
Sharp eyes peered through thick lenses. Then Mrs. Dunwoody said,
"I done it once. Can't do it again. Not that way."
"'I know, but we got to do something.'
Mrs. Dunwoody sighed.
"'It's true what they say. Live long enough, you see all your birds come home to roost. Isn't there another way?'
Mrs. Dunwoody finished stuffing the turkey. She picked up a skewer, pinned the flap of skin closed, then she covered the bird with silver foil.
"'I reckon,' she said. "'I put it on to cook late tomorrow morning. It'd be done in the afternoon. Then I put it back into a hot oven early evening to get it all ready for dinner.'
"'Who you got coming to dinner?'
asked Mrs. Higgler.
"'You,'
said Mrs. Dunwoody.
"'Zora Bustamante, Bella Knowles, and Fat Charlie Nancy. By the time that boy gets here, you have a real appetite.'
Mrs. Higgler said,
"'He's coming here?'
"'Aren't you listening, girl?'
said Mrs. Dunwoody. Only Mrs. Dunwoody could have called Mrs. Higgler girl without sounding foolish.
"'Now, help me get this turkey into the fridge.'
It would be fair to say that Rosie had, that evening, just had the most wonderful night of her life. Magical, perfect, utterly fine. She could not have stopped smiling, not even if she had wanted to. The food had been fabulous, and once they'd eaten, Fat Charlie had taken her dancing. It was a proper dance hall, with a small orchestra, and people in pastel clothes who glided across the floor. She felt as if they'd travelled in time together and were visiting a gentler age. Rosie had enjoyed dancing lessons from the age of 5, but had no one to dance with.
"'I didn't know you could dance,' she told him.
"'There are so many things about me you do not know,' he said, and that made her happy. Soon enough, she and this man would be married, and there were things about him she did not know.
Excellent!
She would have a lifetime in which to find them out. All sorts of things. She noticed the way other women and other men looked at Fat Charlie as she walked beside him, and she was happy she was the woman on his arm. They walked through Leicester Square, and Rosie could see the stars shining up above them, the starlight somehow crisply twinkling, despite the glare of the streetlights. For a brief moment she found herself wondering why it had never been like this with Fat Charlie before. Sometimes, somewhere deep inside herself, Rosie had suspected that perhaps she'd only kept going out with Fat Charlie because her mother disliked him so much, that she'd only said yes when he'd asked her to marry him because her mother would have wanted her to say no. Fat Charlie had taken her out to the West End once. They'd gone to the theatre. It was a birthday surprise for her, but there'd been a mix-up on the tickets, which, it turned out, had actually been issued for the day before. The management were both understanding and extremely helpful, and they had managed to find Fat Charlie a seat behind a pillar in the stalls, while Rosie took a seat in the upper circle behind a violently giggly hen party from Norwich. It had not been a success, not as these things were counted. This evening, though, this evening had been magic. Rosie had not had many perfect moments in her life, but whatever the total was, it had just gone up by one. She loved how she felt when she was with him, and once the dancing was done, after they had stumbled out into the night giddy on movement and champagne, then Fat Charlie, and she thought, why did she think of him as Fat Charlie anyway, for he wasn't the least bit fat, put his arm round her and said, "Now you're coming back to my place," in a voice so deep and real it made her abdomen vibrate, and she said nothing about working the next day, nothing about there'd be time enough for that kind of thing when they were married, nothing at all, in fact, while all the time she thought about how much she didn't want the evening to end, and how very, very much she wished, no, she needed to kiss this man on the lips and to hold him. And then, remembering she had to say something, she said,
"Yes."
In the cab back to his flat, her hands held his, and she leaned against him and stared at him as the light from passing cars and street lamps illuminated his face.
"You have a pierced ear," she said. "Why didn't I ever notice before that you have a pierced ear?"
"Hey," he said with a smile, his voice a deep bass thrum. "How do you think that makes me feel, when you've never even noticed something like that, even when we've been together for what is it now?"
18 months,
said Rosie.
"For 18 months,
said her fiancé. She leaned against him, breathed him in.
"I love the way you smell," she told him. "Are you wearing some kind of cologne?"
"That's just me," he told her.
"Well, you should bottle it."
She paid the taxi while he opened the front door. They went up the stairs together. When they got to the top of the stairs, he seemed to be heading along the corridor towards the spare room at the back.
"You know," she said, "the bedroom's here, silly. Where are you going?"
"Nowhere."
"I knew that," he said.
They went into Fat Charlie's bedroom. She closed the curtains. Then she just looked at him and was happy.
"Well," she said, after a while, "aren't you going to try to kiss me?"
"I guess I am," he said, and he did.
Time melted and stretched and curved. She might have kissed him for a moment, or for an hour, or for a lifetime, and then...
"What was that?"
He said,
"I didn't hear anything."
"It sounded like someone in pain."
"Cats fighting, maybe?"
"It sounded like a person."
"Could have been an urban fox. They can sound a lot like people."
She stood there with her head tipped to one side, listening intently.
"It's stopped now," she said. "You want to know the strangest thing?"
"Mm-hmm,"
he said, his lips now nuzzling her neck.
"Sure. Tell me the strangest thing. But I've made it go away now. It won't bother you again."
"The strangest thing," said Rosie, "is that it sounded like you."
Fat Charlie walked the streets, trying to clear his head. The obvious course of action was to bang on his own front door until Spider came down and let him in, then to give Spider and Rosie a piece of his mind. That was obvious. Perfectly, utterly obvious. He just needed to go back to his flat and explain the whole thing to Rosie and shame Spider into leaving him alone. That was all he had to do. How hard could that be? Harder than it ought to be, that was for certain. He was not quite sure why he had walked away from his flat. He was even less certain how to find his way back. Streets he knew, or thought he knew, seemed to have reconfigured themselves. He found himself walking down dead ends, exploring endless cul-de-sacs, stumbling through the tangles of late-night London residential streets. Sometimes he saw the main road. There were traffic lights on it and the lights of fast food places. He knew that once he got onto the main road, he would be able to find his way back to his house, but whenever he walked on the main road, he would wind up somewhere else. Fat Charlie's feet were starting to hurt. His stomach rumbled violently. He was angry, and as he walked, he became angrier and angrier. The anger cleared his head. The cobwebs surrounding his thoughts began to evaporate. The web of streets he was walking began to simplify. He turned a corner and found himself on the main road, next to the all-night New Jersey Fried Chicken outlet. He ordered a family pack of chicken and sat and finished it off without any help from anyone else in his family. When that was done, he stood on the pavement until the friendly orange light of a for-hire sign attached to a large black cab came into view, and he hailed the cab. It pulled up next to him, and the window rolled down.
"Where to?"
"Maxwell Gardens," said Fat Charlie.
"You taking a mickey or something?" asked the cab driver. "That's just round the corner."
"Will you take me there? I'll give you an extra fiver. Honest." The cabbie breathed in loudly through his clenched teeth. It was the noise a car mechanic makes before asking you whether you're particularly attached to that engine for sentimental reasons.
"It's your funeral," said the cabbie. "Hop in."
Fat Charlie hopped. The cabbie pulled out, waiting for the lights to change, went round the corner.
"Where did you say you wanted to go?" asked the cabbie.
"Maxwell Gardens," said Fat Charlie. "Number 34. It's just past the off-license." He was wearing yesterday's clothes, and he wished he wasn't. His mother had always told him to wear clean underwear in case he was hit by a car, and to brush his teeth in case they needed to identify him by his dental records.
"I know where it is," said the cabbie. "It's just before you get to Park Crescent."
"That's right," said Fat Charlie. He was falling asleep in the back seat.
"I must have taken a wrong turning," said the cabbie.
He sounded irritated.
"I'll turn off the meter, all right. Call it a fiver."
"Sure," said Fat Charlie, and he snuggled down in the back seat of the taxi, and he slept. The taxi drove on through the night, trying to get just around the corner. Detective Constable Day, currently on a 12-month secondment to the fraud squad, arrived at the offices of the Graham Coates Agency at 9:30 a.m. Graham Coates was waiting for her in reception, and he walked her back into his office.
"Would you care for a coffee? Tea?" "No, thank you, I'm fine."
She pulled out a notebook and sat looking at him expectantly.
"Now, I cannot stress enough that discretion must needs be the essence of your investigations. The Graham Coates Agency has a reputation for probity and fair dealing. At the Graham Coates Agency, a client's money is a sacrosanct trust. I must tell you that when I first began to entertain suspicions about Charles Nancy, I dismissed them as unworthy of a decent man and a hard worker. Had you asked me a week ago what I thought about Charles Nancy, I would have told you that he was the very salt of the earth."
"I'm sure you would. So when did you become aware that money might have been diverted from clients' accounts?"
"Well, I'm still not certain. I hesitate to cast aspersions, or first stones for that matter. Judge not, lest ye be judged.
On television, thought Daisy, they say just give me the facts. She wished she could say, but she didn't. She did not like this man.
I've printed out all the anomalous transactions here, he said. As you'll see, they were all made from Nancy's computer. I must again stress that discretion is of the essence here. Clients of the Graham Coates Agency include a number of prominent public figures, and, as I said to your superior, I would count it as a personal favour if this matter could be dealt with as quietly as possible. Discretion must be your watchword. If, perchance, we can persuade our master Nancy simply to return his ill-gotten gains, I would be perfectly satisfied to let the matter rest there. I have no desire to prosecute.
I can do my best, but at the end of the day we gather information and turn it over to the Crown Prosecution Service.
She wondered how much pull he really had with the Chief Super.
So what attracted your suspicions?
Ah, yes, frankly and in all honesty, it was certain peculiarities of behaviour. The dog that failed to bark in the night time, the depth the parsley had sunk into the butter. We detectives find significance in the smallest things, do we not, Detective Day?
Detective Constable Day, really. So if you can give me the printouts, she said, along with any other documentation, bank records, all that, we may actually need to pick up his computer to look at the hard disk.
Absolutely, he said.
His desk phone rang, and,
if you'll excuse me,
he answered it.
He is. Good Lord. Well, tell him just to wait for me in reception. I'll come out and see him in a moment.
He put down the phone.
That, he said to Daisy, is what I believe you would call, in police circles, a right turn-up for the books.
She raised an eyebrow.
That is the aforementioned Charles Nancy himself here to see me. Shall we show him in? If you need to, you may use my offices as an interview room. I'm sure I even have a tape recorder you might borrow.
Daisy said,
That won't be necessary. And the first thing I'll need to do is go through all the paperwork.
Righto, he said. Silly of me. Would you like to look at him?
I don't see that that would accomplish anything, said Daisy.
Oh, I wouldn't tell him you were investigating him, Graham Coates assured her. Otherwise he'd be off to the Costa del Crime before we could say prima facie evidence. Frankly, I like to think of myself as being extremely sympathetic to the problems of contemporary policing.
Daisy caught herself thinking that anyone who would steal money from this man could not be all bad, which was, she knew, no way for a police officer to think.
I'll lead you out, he said to her.
In the waiting room, a man was sitting. He looked as if he had slept in his clothes. He was unshaven, and he looked a little confused. Graham Coates nudged Daisy and inclined his head towards the man. Aloud, he said,
Charles, good Lord, man, look at the state of you. You look terrible.
Fat Charlie looked at him blearily. Didn't get home last night, he said. Bit of a mix-up with the taxi.
Charles, said Graham Coates, this is Detective Constable Day of the Metropolitan Police. She's just here on routine business.
Fat Charlie realized there was someone else there. He focused, saw the sensible clothes that might as well have been a uniform. Then he saw the face.
He said. Morning, said Daisy.
That was what she said with her mouth. Inside her head she was going,
Oh, bollocks, oh, bollocks, oh, bollocks,
over and over. Nice to meet you, said Fat Charlie. Puzzled. He did something he'd never done before. He imagined a plainclothes police officer with no clothes on, and found his imagination was providing him with a fairly accurate representation of the young lady beside whom he had woken up in bed the morning after his father's wake. The sensible clothes made her look slightly older, more severe, and much scarier. But it was her, all right. Like all sentient beings, Fat Charlie had a weirdness quotient. For some days the needle had been over in the red, occasionally banging jerkily against the pin. Now the meter broke. From this moment on, he suspected, nothing would surprise him. He could no longer be out-weirded. He was done. He was wrong, of course. Fat Charlie watched Daisy leave, and he followed Graham Coates back into his office. Graham Coates closed the door firmly. Then he perched his bottom against his desk and smiled like a weasel who has just realized that he's been accidentally locked into the hen house for the night.
Let us be blunt, he said. Cards on the table, no beating about the bush. Let us, he elaborated, let us call a spade a spade.
All right, said Fat Charlie.
Let's.
You said you had something for me to sign?
No longer an operative statement. Dismiss it from your mind. No. Let us now discuss something you pointed out to me several days ago. You alerted me to certain unorthodox transactions occurring here.
I did.
Two, as they say, Charles. Two can play at that game. Naturally, my first impulse was to investigate. Thus the visit this morning from Detective Constable Day. And what I found will, I suspect, not come as a shock to you.
It won't.
No, indeed. There are, as you pointed out, definite indicators of financial irregularities, Charles. But, alas, there is only one place to which the fickle finger of suspicion unerringly points.
There is.
There is.
Fat Charlie felt completely at sea.
Where?
Graham Coates attempted to look concerned, or at least to look as if he were trying to look concerned, managing an expression which in babies always indicates that they're in need of a good burping.
You, Charles, the police suspect you.
Yes, said Fat Charlie, of course they do. It's been that sort of a day. And he went home.
Spider opened the front door. It had started raining, and Fat Charlie stood there looking rumpled and wet.
So, said Fat Charlie, I'm allowed home now, am I?
I wouldn't do anything to stop you, said Spider. It's your home after all. Where were you all night?
You know perfectly well where I was. I was failing to come home. I don't know what kind of magic fluence you were using on me.
Wasn't magic, said Spider, offended. It was a miracle.
Fat Charlie pushed past him and stomped up the stairs. He walked into the bathroom, put in the plug and turned on the taps. He leaned out into the hall.
I don't care what it's called. You're doing it in my house, and you stopped me coming home last night.
He took off the day before yesterday's clothes. Then he put his head back around the door.
And the police are investigating me at work. Did you tell Graham Coase that there were financial irregularities going on?
Of course I did, said Spider.
Ha! Well, he only suspects me, that's what.
Oh, I don't think he does, said Spider.
Shows all you know, said Fat Charlie. I talked to him. The police are involved. And then there's Rosie, and you and I are going to have a very long conversation about Rosie when I get out of the bath. But first of all, I'm going to get into the bath. I spent yesterday night wandering around. I got the only sleep of the night in the back seat of a taxi. By the time I woke up, it was 5 in the morning, and my taxi driver was turning into Travis Bickle. He was conducting a monologue. I told him we might as well give up looking for Maxwell Gardens, and that it obviously wasn't a Maxwell Gardens kind of night. And eventually, he agreed. So we went and had breakfast in one of those places taxi drivers have breakfast. Eggs and beans and sausages and toast and tea you could stand a spoon up in. When he told the other taxi drivers he'd been driving all round last night looking for Maxwell Gardens, well, I thought blood was going to be spilled. It wasn't, but it looked a pretty close thing for a minute there. Fat Charlie stopped to take a breath. Spider looked guilty.
After, said Fat Charlie. After my bath.
He shut the bathroom door. He climbed into the bath. He made a whimpering noise. He climbed out of the bath. He turned off the taps. He wrapped a towel around his midriff and opened the bathroom door.
No hot water, he said, much, much too calmly.
Do you have any idea why we have no hot water?
Spider was still standing in the hallway. He hadn't moved.
My hot tub, he said. Sorry.
Fat Charlie said, well, at least Rosie doesn't.
I mean, she wouldn't have.
And then he caught the expression on Spider's face. Fat Charlie said, I want you out of here. Out of my life. Out of Rosie's life. Gone.
I like it here, said Spider. You're ruining my bloody life. Tough.
Spider walked down the hallway and opened the door to Fat Charlie's spare room. Golden tropical sunlight flooded the hallway momentarily. Then the door was closed. Fat Charlie washed his hair in cold water. He brushed his teeth. He rummaged through his laundry hamper until he found a pair of jeans and a t-shirt that were, by virtue of being at the bottom, practically clean once more. He put them on, along with a purple sweater with a teddy bear on it his mother had once given him that he had never worn but had never got round to giving away. He went down to the end of the corridor. The boom-chagger boom of a bass and drums penetrated the door. Fat Charlie rattled the door handle. It didn't budge.
If you don't open this door, he said, I'm going to break it down.
The door opened without warning, and Fat Charlie lurched inward into the empty box room at the end of the hall. The view through the window was the back of the house behind, what little you could see of it through the rain that was now lashing the window pane. Still, from somewhere only a wall's thinness away, a stereo was playing too loudly. Everything in the box room vibrated to a distant boom-chagga-boom.
Right, said Fat Charlie conversationally. You realize, of course, that this means war. It was the traditional war cry of the rabbit when pushed too far. There are places in which people believe that Anansi was a trickster rabbit. They were wrong, of course. He was a spider. You might think the two creatures would be easy to keep separate, but they still get confused more often than you would expect. Fat Charlie went into his bedroom. He retrieved his passport from the drawer by his bed. He found his wallet where he'd left it, in the bathroom. He walked down to the main road in the rain and hailed a taxi.
"Where to?"
"Heathrow," said Fat Charlie.
"Right you are," said the cabbie. "Which terminal?"
"No idea," said Fat Charlie, who knew that really he ought to know. It had only been a few days after all. "Where do they leave for Florida?" Graham Coates had begun planning his exit from the Graham Coates Agency back when John Major was Prime Minister. Nothing good lasts forever, after all. Sooner or later, as Graham Coates himself would have delighted in assuring you, even if your goose habitually lays golden eggs, it will still be cooked. While his planning had been good, one never knew when one might need to leave at a moment's notice, and he was not unaware that events were massing, like grey clouds on the horizon. He wished to put off the moment of leaving until it could be delayed no longer. What was important, he had long ago decided, was not leaving, but vanishing, evaporating, disappearing without a trace. In the concealed safe in his office, a walk-in room he was extremely proud of, on a shelf he had put up himself and had recently needed to put up again when it fell down, was a leather vanity case containing two passports, one in the name of Basil Finnegan, the other in the name of Roger Bronstein. Each of the men had been born about 50 years ago, just as Graham Coates had, but had died in their first year of life. Both of the passport photographs and the passports were of Graham Coates. The case also contained two wallets, each with its own set of credit cards and photographic identification in the name of one of the names of the passport holders. Each name was a signatory to the funnel account in the Caymans, which themselves funneled to other accounts in the British Virgin Islands, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein. Graham Coates had been planning to leave for good on his 50th birthday, a little more than a year from now, and he was brooding on the matter of Fat Charlie. He did not actually expect Fat Charlie to be arrested or imprisoned, although he would not have greatly objected to either scenario had it occurred. He wanted him scared, discredited, and gone. Graham Coates truly enjoyed milking the clients of the Graham Coates Agency, and he was good at it. He had been pleasantly surprised to discover that as long as he picked his clientele with care, the celebrities and performers he represented had very little sense of money, and that they were relieved to find someone who would represent them and manage their financial affairs and make sure that they didn't have to worry. And if sometimes statements or checks were late in coming, or if they weren't always what the clients were expecting, or if there were unidentified direct debits from client accounts, well, Graham Coates had a high staff turnover, particularly in the bookkeeping department, and there was nothing that couldn't easily be blamed on the incompetence of a previous employee, or, rarely, made right with a case of champagne and a large and apologetic check. It wasn't that people liked Graham Coates, or that they trusted him. Even the people he represented thought he was a weasel. But they believed that he was their weasel, and in that they were wrong. Graham Coates was his own weasel. The telephone on his desk rang and he picked it up.
"Yes?"
"Mr. Coates, it's Maeve Livingstone on the phone. I know you said to put her through to Fat Charlie, but he's off this week, and I wasn't sure what to say. Shall I tell you you're out?"
Graham Coates pondered. Before a sudden heart attack had carried him off, Maurice Livingstone, once the best-loved short Yorkshire comedian in the country, had been the star of such television series as Short Back and Sides, and his own Saturday Night Variety game show, Maurice Livingstone, I presume. He had even had a top 10 single back in the 80s, with the novelty song It's Nice Out, But Put It Away. Amiable, easygoing, he had not only left all his financial affairs in the control of the Graham Coates Agency, but he had also appointed, at Graham Coates' suggestion, Graham Coates himself as trustee of his estate. It would have been criminal not to give in to a temptation like that. And then there was Maeve Livingstone. It would be fair to say that Maeve Livingstone had, without knowing it, featured for many years in starring and co-starring roles in a number of Graham Coates' most treasured and private fantasies. Graham Coates said, "Please put her through," and then solicitously, "Maeve, how lovely to hear from you. How are you?" "I'm not sure," she said. Maeve Livingstone had been a dancer when she met Maurice, and had always towered over the little man. They had adored each other.
"Why don't you tell me all about it?"
"I spoke to Charles a couple of days ago. I was wondering..." "Well, the bank manager was wondering. The money from Maurice's estate. We were told we'd be seeing something by now."
"Maeve,"
said Graham Coates in what he thought of as his dark velvet voice, the one he believed that women responded to. The problem is not that the money is not there. It's merely a matter of liquidity. As I've told you, Morris made a number of unwise investments toward the end of his life, and although, following my advice, he made some sound ones as well, we do need to allow the good ones to mature. We cannot pull out now without losing almost everything. But worry ye not, anything for a good client. I shall write you a check from my own bank account in order to keep you solvent and comfortable. How much does the bank manager require?
He says that he's going to have to start bouncing checks, she said. And the BBC tell me that they've been sending money from the DVD releases of the old shows. That's not invested, is it?
That's what the BBC said. Actually, we've been chasing them for money. But I wouldn't want to put all the blame on BBC Worldwide. Our bookkeeper's pregnant, and things have been all at sixes and sevens, and Charles Nancy, who you spoke to, has been rather distraught. His father died, and he's been out of the country a great deal.
Last time we spoke, she pointed out, you were putting in a new computer system.
Indeed we were, and please do not get me started on the subject of bookkeeping programs. What is it they say? To err is human, but to really mess things up you need a computer? Something like that. I shall investigate this forcefully, by hand if necessary, the old-fashioned way, and your money shall be wending their way to you. It's what Morris would have wanted.
My bank manager says I need £10,000 in right now just to stop them bouncing checks.
£10,000 shall be yours. I am writing a check for you even as we speak. He drew a circle on his notepad with a line going off the top of it. It looked a bit like an apple.
I'm very grateful, said Maeve, and Graham Coates preened. I hope I'm not becoming a bother.
You are never a bother, said Graham Coates. No sort of bother at all.
He put down the phone. The funny thing, Graham Coates always thought, was that Morris's comedic persona had always been that of a hard-headed Yorkshireman, proud of knowing the location of every penny. It had been a fine game, thought Graham Coates, and he added two eyes to the apple and a couple of ears. It now looked, he decided, more or less like a cat. Soon enough it would be time to exchange a life of milking hard-to-please celebrities for a life of sunshine, swimming pools, fine meals, good wines, and, if possible, enormous quantities of oral sex. The best things in life, Graham Coates was convinced, could all be bought and paid for. He drew a mouth on the cat and filled it with sharp teeth, so it looked a little like a mountain lion, and as he drew, he began to sing in a reedy tenor voice.
When I were a young man, my father would say, it's lovely outside, you should go out to play. But now that I'm older, the ladies will say, it's nice out, but put it away.
Morris Livingstone had bought and paid for Graham Coates' penthouse flat on the Copacabana, and for the installation of the swimming pool on the island of St. Andrews, and he must not imagine that Graham Coates was not grateful.
It's nice out, but put it away.
Spider felt odd. There was something going on, a strange feeling spreading like a mist through his life, and it was ruining his day. He could not identify it, and he did not like it. And if there was one thing that he was definitely not feeling, it was guilty. It simply wasn't the kind of thing he ever felt. He felt excellent. Spider felt cool. He did not feel guilty. He would not have felt guilty if he was caught red-handed holding up a bank. And yet there was, all about him, a faint miasma of discomfort. Until now, Spider had believed that gods were different. They had no consciences, nor did they need them. A god's relationship to the world, even a world in which he was walking, was about as emotionally connected as that of a computer gamer playing with the knowledge of the overall shape of the game and armed with a complete set of cheat codes. Spider kept himself amused. That was what he did. That was the important bit. He would not have recognized guilt if he had an illustrated guide to it, with all the component parts clearly labeled. It was not that he was feckless, more that he had simply not been around the day they handed out feck. But something had changed. Inside him or outside, he was not sure. And it bothered him. He poured himself another drink. He waved a hand and made the music louder. He changed it from Miles Davis to James Brown. It still didn't help. He lay on the hammock, in the tropical sunshine, listening to the music, basking in how extremely cool it was to be him. And for the first time, even that, somehow, wasn't enough. He climbed out of the hammock and wandered over to the door.
Fat Charlie!
There was no answer. The flat felt empty. Outside the windows of the flat there was a grey day and rain. Spider liked the rain. It seemed appropriate. Shrill and sweet, the telephone rang. Spider picked it up. Rosie said, "Is that you?"
"Hello, Rosie."
"Last night," she said. Then she didn't say anything. Then she said, "Was it as wonderful for you as it was for me?"
"I don't know," said Spider. "It was pretty wonderful for me. So, I mean, that's probably a yes."
She said. They didn't say anything.
"Charlie," said Rosie.
"Uh-huh."
"I even like not saying anything, just knowing you're on the other end of the phone."
"Me too," said Spider.
They enjoyed the sensation of not saying anything for a while longer, savoring it, making it last. "Do you want to come over to my place tonight?" asked Rosie. "My flatmates are in the Cairngorms."
"That," said Spider, "may be a candidate for the most beautiful phrase in the English language. My flatmates are in the Cairngorms. Perfect poetry." She giggled.
"Twit, bring your toothbrush?"
Oh, okay.
And after several minutes of, "You put the phone down," and,
"No, you put the phone down," that would have done credit to a pair of hormonally intoxicated 15-year-olds, the phone was eventually put down.
Spider smiled like a saint. The world, given that it had Rosie in it, was the best world that any world could possibly be. The fog had lifted, the world had ungloomed. It did not even occur to Spider to wonder where Fat Charlie had gone. Why should he care about such trivia? Rosie's flatmates were in the Cairngorms, and tonight? Why, tonight, he would be bringing his toothbrush. Fat Charlie's body was on a plane to Florida. It was crushed in a seat in the middle of a row of five people, and it was fast asleep. This was a good thing. The rear toilets had malfunctioned as soon as the plane was in the air, and although the cabin attendants had hung out-of-order signs on the doors, this did nothing to alleviate the smell, which spread slowly across the back of the plane like a low-level chemical fog. There were babies crying, and adults grumbling, and children whining. One faction of the passengers en route to Walt Disney World, who felt that their holidays began the moment they got on the plane, had got settled into their seats, then began a sing-song. They sang Bibbidi-Bobbidi-Boo, and The Wonderful Thing About Tiggers, and Under the Sea, and Hey-Ho, Hey-Ho, It's Off to Work We Go, and even under the impression that it was a Disney song as well, were off to see The Wizard. Once the plane was in the air, it was discovered that, due to a catering confusion, no coach-class lunch meals had been put on board. Instead, only breakfasts had been packed, which meant there would be individual packs of cereal and a banana for all passengers, which they would have to eat with plastic knives and forks, because there were, unfortunately, no spoons, which may have been a good thing, because pretty soon there wasn't any milk for the cereal either. It was a hell flight, and Fat Charlie was sleeping through it. In Fat Charlie's dream, he was in a huge hall, and he was wearing a morning suit. Next to him was Rosie, wearing a white wedding dress, and on the other side of her on the dais was Rosie's mother, who was, a little jarringly, also wearing a wedding dress, although this one was covered with dust and with cobwebs. Far away at the horizon, which was the distant edge of the hall, there were people firing guns and waving white flags.
"It's just the people at Table H," said Rosie's mother. "Don't pay them no attention."
Fat Charlie turned to Rosie. She smiled at him with her soft, sweet smile. Then she licked her lips.
"Cake," said Rosie, in his dream.
This was the signal for an orchestra to begin to play. It was a New Orleans jazz band, playing a funeral march. The chef's assistant was a police officer. She was holding a pair of handcuffs. The chef wheeled the cake up onto the dais.
"Now,"
said Rosie to Fat Charlie in his dream,
"cut the cake."
The people at Table B, who were not people but cartoon mice and rats and barnyard animals, human-sized and celebrating, began to sing songs from Disney cartoons. Fat Charlie knew that they wanted him to join in with them. Even asleep, he could feel himself panicking at the simple idea of having to sing in public, his limbs becoming numb, his lips prickling. "I can't sing with you," he told them, desperate for an excuse. "I have to cut the cake." At this, the hall fell into silence, and in the silence, a chef entered, wheeling a little trolley with something on it. The chef wore Graham Coates's face, and on the trolley was an extravagant white wedding cake, an ornate, many-tiered confection. A tiny bride and tiny groom perched precariously on the topmost tier of the cake, like two people trying to keep their balance on top of a sugar-frosted Chrysler building. Rosie's mother reached under the table and produced a long, wooden-handled knife, almost a machete, with a rusty blade.
She passed it to Rosie, who reached for Fat Charlie's right hand and placed it over her own. And together, they pressed the rusty knife into the thick white icing on the topmost tier of the cake, pushed it in between the groom and the bride. The cake resisted the blade at first, and Fat Charlie pressed harder, putting all his weight on the knife. He felt the cake beginning to give. He pushed harder. The blade sliced through the topmost tier of the wedding cake. It slipped and sliced down the cake, through every layer and tier, and as it did so, the cake opened. In his dream, Fat Charlie supposed that the cake was filled with black beads, with beads of black glass or of polished jet, and then, as they tumbled out of the cake, he realized that the beads had legs. Each bead had 8 clever legs, and they came out the inside of the cake like a black wave. The spiders surged forward and covered the white tablecloth. They covered Rosie's mother and Rosie herself, turning their white dresses black as ebony. Then, as if controlled by some vast and malignant intelligence, they flowed in their hundreds towards Fat Charlie. He turned to run, but his legs were trapped in some kind of rubbery tanglefoot, and he tumbled to the floor. Now they were upon him, their tiny legs crawling over his bare skin, and he tried to get up, but he was drowning in spiders. Fat Charlie wanted to scream, but his mouth was filled with spiders. They covered his eyes, and his world went dark. Fat Charlie opened his eyes and saw nothing but blackness, and he screamed, and he screamed, and he screamed. Then he realized the lights were off, and the window shades were drawn, because people were watching the film. It was already a flight from hell. Fat Charlie had just made it a little worse for everyone else. He stood up and tried to get out to the aisle, tripping over people as he went past. Then, when he was almost at the gangway, straightening up and banging the overhead locker with his forehead, which knocked open the locker door and tumbled someone's hand luggage down onto his head. People nearby, the ones who were watching, laughed. It was an elegant piece of slapstick, and it cheered them all up no end. Chapter 7, in which Fat Charlie goes a long way. The immigration officer squinted at Fat Charlie's American passport, as if she were disappointed he was not a foreign national of the kind she could simply stop coming into the country. Then, with a sigh, she waved him through. He wondered what he was going to do once he got through customs. Rent a car, he supposed, and eat. He got off the tram and walked through the security barrier, out into the wide shopping concourse of Orlando Airport, and was nowhere nearly as surprised as he should have been to see Mrs. Higgler standing there, scanning the faces of the arrivals, her enormous mug of coffee clutched in her hand. They saw each other at more or less the same moment, and she headed towards him.
"You're hungry?"
she asked him. He nodded.
"Well," she said, "I hope you like turkey."
Fat Charlie wondered if Mrs. Higgler's maroon station wagon was the same car he remembered her driving when he was a boy. He suspected that it was. It must have been new once. That stood to reason. Everything was new once, after all. The seats were cracked and flaking leather. The dashboard was a dusty wooden veneer. A brown paper shopping bag sat between them on the seat. There was no cup holder in Mrs. Higgler's ancient car, and she clamped the jumbo mug of coffee between her thighs as she drove. The car appeared to predate air conditioning, and she drove with the windows down. Fat Charlie did not mind. After the damp chill of England, the Florida heat was welcome. Mrs. Higgler headed south towards the toll road. She talked as she drove. She talked about the last hurricane, and about how she took her nephew Benjamin to SeaWorld and to Walt Disney World, and how none of the tourist resorts were what they once were, about building codes, the price of gas, exactly what she had said to the doctor who had suggested a hip replacement, why tourists kept feeding gators, and why newcomers built houses on the beaches and were all surprised when the beach or the house went away, or the gators ate their dogs. Fat Charlie let it all wash over him. It was just talk. Mrs. Higgler slowed down and took the ticket that would take her down the toll road. She stopped talking. She seemed to be thinking.
"So," she said, "you met your brother."
"You know," said Fat Charlie, "you could have warned me."
"I did warn you that he's a god."
"You didn't mention that he was a complete and utter pain in the arse, though." Mrs. Higgler sniffed. She took a swig of coffee from her mug. "Is there anywhere we can stop and get a bite to eat?" asked Fat Charlie. "They only had cereal and bananas on the plane, no spoons, and they ran out of milk before they got to my row. They said they were sorry and gave us all food vouchers to make up for it." Mrs. Higgler shook her head. "I could have used my voucher to get a hamburger in the airport."
"I tell you already," said Mrs. Higgler. "Luella Dunwiddie been cooking you a turkey."
How do you think she feels if we get there and you fill up already at McDonald's and you ain't got no appetite, eh?
But I'm starving, and it's over 2 hours away.
Not, she said firmly, the way I drive.
And with that, she put her foot down. Every now and then, as the maroon station wagon shuddered down the freeway, Fat Charlie would close his eyes tightly, while at the same time pushing his own left foot down on an imaginary brake pedal. It was exhausting work. In significantly less than 2 hours, they reached the tollway exit and got onto a local highway. They drove toward the city. They drove past the Barnes & Noble and the office depot. They went past the seven-figure houses with security gates. They went down the older residential streets, which Fat Charlie remembered as being much better cared for when he was a boy. They went past the West Indian Takeaway and the restaurant with the Jamaican flag in the windows, with handwritten signs pushing the oxtails and rice specials and the homemade ginger beer and the curry chicken. Fat Charlie's mouth watered. His stomach made a noise. A lurch and a bounce. Now the houses were older, and this time everything was familiar. The pink plastic flamingos were still striking attitudes in Mrs. Dunwoody's front yard, although the sun had faded them almost white over the years. There was a mirrored gazing ball as well, and when Fat Charlie spotted it, he was, only for a moment, as scared as he'd ever been of anything.
"How bad is it with Spider?"
asked Mrs. Higgler as they walked up to Mrs. Dunwoody's front door. "Put it this way," said Fat Charlie. "I think he's sleep with my fiancé, which is rather more than I ever did."
"Ah,"
said Mrs. Higgler. And she rang the doorbell. It was sort of like Macbeth, thought Fat Charlie an hour later. In fact, if the witches in Macbeth had been four little old ladies, and if instead of stirring cauldrons and intoning dread incantations, they'd just welcomed Macbeth in and fed him on turkey and rice and peas, spread out on white china plates on a red and white patterned plastic tablecloth, not to mention sweet potato pudding and spicy cabbage, and encouraged him to take second helpings and thirds, and then, when Macbeth had declaimed that nay, he was stuffed nigh on to bursting and on his oath could truly eat no more, the witches had pressed upon him their own special island rice pudding and a large slice of Mrs. Bustamante's famous pineapple upside-down cake, it would have been exactly like Macbeth.
"So,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody, scratching a crumb of pineapple upside-down cake from the corner of her mouth.
"I understand your brother came to see you."
"Yes, I talked to a spider. I suppose it was my own fault. I never expected anything to happen." A chorus of tuts and tusks and ran round the table as Mrs. Higgler and Mrs. Dunwoody and Mrs. Bustamante and Miss Knowles clicked their tongues and shook their heads.
"You always used to say you were the stupid one," said Miss Knowles. "Your father, that is. I never believed him."
"Well, how was I to know?" Fat Charlie protested. "It's not as if my parents ever said to me, 'By the way, son, you have a brother you don't know about. Invite him into your life and he'll have you investigated by the police. He'll sleep with your fiancé. He'll not just move into your home but bring an entire extra house into your spare room, and he'll brainwash you and make you go to films and spend all night trying to get home, and—'" He stopped. It was the way they were looking at him. A sigh went round the table. It went from Mrs. Higgler to Miss Knowles to Mrs. Bustamante to Mrs. Dunwoody. It was extremely unsettling and quite spooky, but Mrs. Bustamante belched and ruined the effect.
"So what do you want?"
asked Mrs. Dunwoody.
"Say what you want."
Fat Charlie thought about what he wanted, in Mrs. Dunwoody's little dining room. Outside, the daylight was fading into a gentle twilight. "He's made my life a misery," said Fat Charlie. "I want you to make him go away. Just go away. Can you do that?" The three younger women said nothing. They simply looked at Mrs. Dunwoody.
"We can't actually make him go away,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody.
"We already—"
And she stopped herself and said,
"Well, we've done all we can about that, you see."
It is to Fat Charlie's credit in this narrative that he did not, as deep down he might have wished to, burst into tears or wail or collapse in on himself like a problematic souffle. He simply nodded. "Well then," he said, "sorry to have bothered you all. Thank you for the dinner."
"We can't make him go away,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody, her old brown eyes almost black behind her pebble-thick spectacles.
"But we can send you to somebody who can."
It was early evening in Florida, which meant that in London it was the dead of night. In Rose's big bed, where Fat Charlie had never been, Spider shivered. Rosie pressed close to him, skin to skin.
"Charles," she said, "are you all right?"
She could feel the goose pimples bumping the skin of his arms.
"I'm fine," said Spider.
"Sudden creepy feeling."
"'Somebody walking over your grave,' said Rosie. "'He pulled her close then, and he kissed her. "'And Daisy was sitting in the small common room of the house in Hendon, "'wearing a bright green nightdress and fluffy, vivid pink carpet slippers. "'She was sitting in front of a computer screen...